Sochan Rimuyan Upayati Kasmalam Kvachich Chagandharva Puram Pravishta Pramodate Nirvittavan Muhurtam. Surai, my very powerful enemies. Ritasa, of all those possessions have been stolen. Kvacha, sometimes. Nirvinachita, very morose and aggrieved at heart. Sochan, deeply lamenting. Vimulyan, becoming bewildered. Upayati, achieves. Kasmalam, unconsciousness. Kvachit, sometimes. Cha, also. Gandharvapuram, an imaginary city in the forest. Pravishta, having entered. Pramodate, he enjoys. Nivritavat, exactly like a person who has achieved success. Muhurtam, for a moment only. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes being defeated or plundered by superior, powerful agent, a living entity loses his possessions. He then becomes very morose, and lamenting their loss, he sometimes become unconscious. Sometimes he imagines a great palatial city in which he desires to live happily with his family members and riches. He thinks himself fully satisfied if this is possible, but such so-called happiness continues only for a moment. Please repeat after me. Sometimes being defeated or plundered by a superior, powerful agent, a living entity loses all possessions. it then becomes very morose and lamenting their loss, he sometimes becomes unconscious. Sometimes he imagines a great palatial city in which he desires to live happily with his family members and riches. He thinks himself fully satisfied if this is possible. But such so-called happiness continues only for a moment. Purport. The word Gandharvapuram is very significant in this verse. Sometimes in the forest a very big castle appears, and this is called a castle in the air, or as we would call it in normal language, pie in the sky. Actually, this castle does not exist anywhere but in one's imagination. This is called Gandharvapura. In the mature forest, the conditioned soul sometimes contemplates great castles and skyscrapers, and he wastes his energy for such things, hoping to live in them very peacefully with his family forever. However, the laws of nature do not allow this. When he enters such a castle, he temporarily thinks that he is very happy, even though his happiness is impermanent. His happiness may last for a few years, but because the owner of the castle has to leave the castle at the time of death, everything is eventually lost. This is the way of worldly transactions. Such happiness is described by Vidyapati as the happiness one derives upon seeing a drop of water in the desert. The desert is heated by scorching sunshine, and if we want to reduce the desert temperature, we need huge amount of water, millions and millions of gallons. What effect will one drop have? Water certainly has value, but one drop of water cannot reduce the heat of the desert. In this material world, everyone is ambitious, but the heat is very scorching. What will an imaginary castle in the air do to help? Srila Vidyapati has therefore sung, Tatala Seikate Vari Bindu Sama Sutta Mita Namani Samaje. The happiness of family life, friends and society is compared to a drop of water in the scorching desert. The entire material world is busy trying to attain happiness because happiness is the prerogative of the living being. Unfortunately, due to falling in contact with the material world, the living entity simply struggles for existence. Even if one becomes happy for a while, a very powerful enemy may plunder everything. There are many instances in which big business suddenly becomes pauper in the desert. Yet the nature of material existence is such that foolish people are attracted to those transactions and they forget the real business of self-realization. Thank you for giving me a chance to speak in Srila Mayapur. This is my second week here, and I'm leaving in a couple of days. And each time I come to the Holy Dham, each time the experience and the realization are totally different. Things are always spiritually and transcendentally in motion. And unless one is attuned spiritually, it's very difficult to actually understand what goes on in the Holy Dham. However, being here is a very good occasion to reflect on what goes on outside of the Holy Dome. Because what goes on outside of the Holy Dome is a very serious situation, unless you've noticed. It's interesting that the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam prove again and again to be timeless. These verses were spoken during a conversation that took place millions of years ago, and when you read them, it's as good as opening the newspaper and getting a full description from a smart journalist about what is going on. And then followed by the purport of the acharyas, which just confirms what the sages are discussing, we get a clear idea, not only of the picture, which never changes, no matter what, it's just the same. We get a picture of what is the situation in the mature world and on the spiritual platform. Now this chapter and the chapter after that describes the activities in the forest of material existence. And the use of analogies is very helpful. But analogies or allegories or metaphors are used, practically speaking, all throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, practically speaking, all throughout the Vedas. Krishna uses metaphors all the time in Bhagavad Gita. People use metaphors in everyday language. We always use metaphors because we need to use words to describe situations so that people can have pictures in their mind and say, yes, I understand. And what's interesting in this chapter and the chapter after, by the way the life in material existence is described in those verses is nothing compared to what's coming up in the next chapter. What's coming up in the next chapter in terms of describing material existence and family life is like, if you're not strong spiritually, you get very depressed. But what's interesting is that in this conversation, at the beginning, Maharaj Rahugana is asking Jat Bharat to give him an easy way to understand the situation of a conditioned soul, because previously Jat Bharat just spoke about the science of the soul, the position of the soul, but the king doesn't get it. And he is a king. Kings are supposed to be intelligent, supposed to be smart, but he didn't get it. So he's asking, can you please explain in a different way, through analogies, can you please explain what is the situation of a conditioned soul? So this chapter describes, through metaphors, what goes on in the forest, in the jungle of material life. In the next chapter, Maharaj Parikshit will ask Shukadev Goswami to give analogies and metaphors to describe. Again, the same thing is going to come up. The same description of the forest, material life in the forest, is going to come up. But the intention is different, because Maharaj Parikshit, and that's in the very first verse, he says, this will benefit the less intelligent people. So this is not Jat Bharat who is confused. This is Maharaj Parikshit who is very foresighted, who understands this Srimad Bhagavatam is going to help people in Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, people don't have that kind of spiritual intelligence required to accept the position of Lord Krishna. So please give them some images. But don't soften your language. Strike. Give proper analogies of what it's like to be entangled in the material world. In the first sentence of the purport of the first verse of the next chapter, Prabhupada says we can make the comparison of material life in the forest to material life in the cities. This has been used again. Metaphors are being used even in other scriptures. It's been used in the Bible. I think 5,400 different metaphors are used in the Bible. Again, why? What is the use of metaphors? Why do we have to describe and paint different images so people can, oh, now I understand. Like, I know personally, if I take a course, I need everything on the board, I need everything on a piece of paper, I need images. I can't just do it through conversation. Did you get it? I think so. But I need graphic examples. That's me. Some people are smart enough to just, okay, I got it, and then they work it out in their minds. But metaphor, especially there, because most people don't understand, and therefore they have to be repeated all throughout the scriptures. Now, there are the metaphors which will be used in poetic language. Many, like for example, Vidyapati in this purport Prabhupada is quoting, he's describing material life in a poetic way. Many devotees often quote Rumi, you know, to have some inspiration about life and death and the soul and relationship and love. Rumi is very famous for using poetic language, and practically speaking, every line of his poems are metaphors. Again, because people do not understand. And what does that mean, they don't understand? It's not that they can't read the words. The words are very simple. But intellectually speaking, even though they can accept how things are written, they don't understand the purport, they don't understand the intention behind it. Therefore, it has to be repeated again and again and again. And that's why Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, we have to study the Srimad Bhagavatam all the time, we never stop. That's why we have to study Prabhupada's books all the time, before any other books. And there are many, many books. This is being mentioned in many of the lectures here and other places. There are so many books. Yesterday I went to the bookstore down there. I was looking for some books. There were Prabhupada's books on the top shelf, and everything else is other publications, practically speaking. So devotees are translating, they're writing, and it's so easy for the general mass of devotees to just go for the latest publication. Oh, I want that new book. I want to know what it's about. Now, we have experience in many places when we ask for devotees to put their hand up if they have actually read Bhagavad Gita, if they read Prabhupada Lilamrita entirely from cover to cover, 6 volumes, if they read the entire Chaitanya Charitamrita, if they can explain or give a summary of the Upadeshamrita, it's only 11 verses, or any of the books that Prabhupada painstakingly has translated and purported, you'd be surprised that many do not. And that's why we have places like VIHE and MIHE and Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhav, and Bhakti Vedanta, Bhakti Sabhadhamma, so that devotees thoroughly study, because there is a difference between reading Prabhupada
and studying Krishna.
We can read. When we have free time, we read. But studying is totally different. Studying means we take notes, we look at the premises of the chapter, the premises of the purports, and then we ask questions, because obviously we do not understand. We just don't get it. Why is it that we... What's to prove that we don't understand? We still have material desires. Otherwise, the first line of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first words of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita should be sufficient. But it's not sufficient. We have to hear again and again. And that applies to everything else that we do in devotional life. One example is chanting japa. Very easy to chant the Maha Mantra, the 16 words. Very easy to chant 16 rounds. But what goes on in the mind while the play of the japa tape is going on, that's a different issue. Because every morning it's the same story. It's the Maha Mantra versus the mind. That's all it is. It's a constant battle. Bhojan Prabhu is begging the devotees in all his japa rituals. It's just one word, right? We did a play one time just imitating him teaching the japa retreat. He loved it. And he was right there. And he just laughed so much. One word. One mantra. Just try. One word. One mantra. So we try. We succeed. I got it. I got one mantra. And soon after, back into conversation with the mind. Instantly. It never stops. It's very, 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 very difficult to put the mantra in the mind and just concentrate on the sound vibration and nothing else. I gave the example to some devotees recently in China. You do the experiment of, for example, you want to eat and breathe at the same time, or drink and breathe at the same time. You don't have many choices. You either drink or you breathe. You can't do both. Similarly, you can't think and chant at the same time if the chanting is done properly. If you hear the sound, the mind is blocked automatically. It's just a biological reaction or physical reaction that if you concentrate on sound, the mind is shut down. But how can we do concentration on the sound vibration and at the same time shut down the mind? We make a choice. What's the easiest? Let's go with the mind. That's how the japa goes. So hopefully, over the years, over time, praying very hard that we can get the chanting to a solid attachment to the sound vibration and then get purified. The same thing with the knowledge that we receive. We hear and we receive so much knowledge. Sometimes I think, personally, too much information. Way too much information. Too fast. And many devotees just go for everything that's being published, everything that's being translated, and we want to read everything. The question is whether it helps in working on being detached from material attachment if it's just to get some information, to know, oh, I know about this, I read about this, but actually what do we do to become detached? And it's not just detached for the sake of detachment, it's detached for the sake of being attached to Krishna. So these metaphors are used for this purpose, so that if we don't understand, it's being repeated again and again and again. The forest of material enjoyment, as Prabhupada explains, it's what we experience every day, whether we live in a jungle, or whether we live in a city, or whether we live in a village. It's the same situation. It's pretty much struggle for existence. The example of the forest is used here because sages do meet in the forest. Most of the conversation that take place, they take place either by the river, by sacred rivers, or they take place in the forest. And if you actually go around the forest or the jungle and you spend enough time there, if you go with a magnifying glass or you just sit there and just pay attention to what's going on, it's just unbelievable. It's very, very busy. It's not just the trees and the plants and the flowers blossoming and a few birds flying here and there. There's millions and millions of creatures that are working very hard just to catch a bug, just to fly to safety. We often give that example in Sunday feast lecture. You say, you think birds chirping means they're happy? No, it means, where's the chapati? Where's the food? I'm starving. Maybe they sound chirpy once they've got the worm, but all the way there, it's misery. And even though they may look beautiful and the chirping sound is so nice to the ear, still, it's suffering. And it's like that for all creatures, just struggling to have the next meal on the plate, struggling to feed our offsprings. So there is no difference. However, yogis do go to the forest to enjoy the mode of goodness. Why do we call that goodness? Because it's still the material world. Therefore, the gunas are very prominent. but especially because it's an expansion of Krishna's energy, as opposed to the cities. The cities are an expansion of people's minds, whether it's ignorance, passion, or goodness. Devotees related when Srila Prabhupada was being picked up at the airport in Paris on an early Sunday morning. And early Sunday morning, you're not going to find many people on the streets. So they drove through the city. If any of you have been to Paris, just like most of the European cities, it's very, very beautiful. And Prabhupada actually didn't know that such a building existed. And when he looked at the buildings, he told the devotees, if this city was Krishna conscious, it would be just like Dwarka. Because it's just, you know, but then a few days later when he was lecturing, he said, I've seen these old men coming out of the nightclubs. Even at 75, they go to the nightclubs and then they hire some young girls and they drink all night. You know, they're all low-class people. Also, when he was being received as an honored guest at the city town hall of Paris, I mean, it's just a magnificent building. Prabhupada also did not know that there were still these ornate sculptures and furniture. And you see, when you look at the video following Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada's walking around, he goes, wow, I didn't know these things existed. It's so beautiful. Some people had the ingenuity to build these things, but for what purpose? Pure sense enjoyment. As a matter of fact, the very famous French castles were originally just little huts in the forest so that the hunters would go and have a break and have something to eat. But then they turn into big parties and they say, why are we going to have a little hut to have parties? Let's do something serious. So then they build all these big castles, which, by the way, don't have any toilets. There's no bathrooms in those days. They used to have people walking around with brass buckets. So the purpose of these beautiful mansions for pure sense gratification, not only this Ugrakarna. Now you have what people build nowadays. I'm not going to mention Calcutta because Calcutta is questionable because Calcutta, the British did something nice with Calcutta and then after the British, it's history. We're not going to go there. But you take, you know, I mean, of course, there's all the major cities in America, like New York, but because my Prabhu Datta Desh is the mainland China, I have seen over the years, over the past 20 years, what the Chinese have done to those cities. Like, just 2 hours away from here is the city of Kunming. It's called the Spring City. And it's called the Spring City because it's supposed to be spring all year, not hot, not cold. And I went there in 1992 for the first time, and going around on bicycles. Wow, this is such a beautiful place. It's so peaceful here. So many parks and gardens. You go there now, it's a war zone. They have trashed the city. They've destroyed it entirely. It's just one building after another. The roads are broken, and they get all the people from the villages to come and live inside and have a big time, have the party of their lives. So the mixture of the modes of material nature, as it's mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, you know, is 3 × 3 × 3, and Krishna explains sometimes ignorance takes over passion, passion takes over goodness, goodness takes over. There's a mixture there, and people become very bewildered because they think, as the verse and the purport explains, I will succeed. I will get happiness. Mark my word. Watch this space. I will get there. And once they get there, two things happen. One is the success begin to crumble. And two, they're not meant to be successful. They're not meant to enjoy to that degree. So inside those amazing fortifications, they behave like animals. And that we've seen. Even people who manage to gather huge amount of money, they don't know what to do with it. And it doesn't matter which country, which culture, because it's not the nature. 99% of the people today, they have a Shudra mentality. This is the nature of Kali Yuga. And therefore, when wealth comes their way, and they have an opportunity to do something very nice with it, they just trash it, and they behave like animals. So that's the behavior of people who are affected by the modes of material nature when they decide to exploit the resources. And there are many examples of that. The Middle East, who are building, I mean, talk about, what's the expression? Gandharvapuram, right? Out of the sand, out of the desert, these huge things manifest. How does that connect with this, the land of the Middle East being so pious, supposedly based on scriptures, so much ethics, but at the same time, all this huge establishment for pure sense gratification. In China, there are something like 200 cities that have been built. And when we say city, we say everything. Shopping mall, buildings, freeways, schools, swimming pools, stadiums, you name it, everything is there. Empty. There's not one person living there. Not a single person. Brand new. You can drive through. They call them ghost cities. There's nobody there. And then you ask what's going on. They say, people will come. At some point they will come, but they'll never come. Like the Chinese go to Africa, pump out all the natural resources, and build entire luxury residential complex for the African people. Can they live there? No, they can't afford it. And even if they could afford it, how would they live in this kind of condition? They probably break down the door just to build some wood to cook something. So the whole system is upside down because people are convinced, I have a dream. I'm not quoting Martin Luther King here. Everyone has a dream. From the time we're born, we dream of something, whether it's a toy or whether it's a pair of blue jeans or whether it's a car or whether it's a... Everyone has a dream. It's just a question of how far we go and what we can do for it. But people will stop at nothing to realize their dreams. And as the purport says, as soon as they have it, it's taken away. So what lesson do we draw from this? Even in other spiritual paths and religions, we've seen how people want to go to extreme and they understand that life is suffering and they should just try to counteract the suffering. Like we in Buddhism, we have the Four Noble Truths, which begins with dukkha, suffering. And each of the Noble Truths deal with getting rid of dukkha until you get to nirvana. Now, what is nirvana? Nir without, vana, without the forest. The forest of material enjoyment. So when Buddhism began to spread, what did people do? Not during the time of Buddha, after. After they created a whole monastic order, both men and women, they went to the forest. Some stayed on the outskirts of the cities. For what? To get donations, to get some food. And they just sat and chanted their mantras all day. Or they moved, and then you had the other group of Buddhists who started traveling from village to village, from forest to forest, and just begging. But the same thing happened. Now, the other day, who was giving class? Someone was talking about, Bhakti Bikash Maharaj. And he was talking about the end of Buddhism. And the question often rises, why did Buddhism not last in India? And there are many, many reasons why. And all these reasons, all these factors, you know, they were building up gradually until they amounted to no more. But one of the main reasons is that everybody wanted to renounce. The social structure of the Indian population was collapsing completely. Not just from the lay people, from the normal class people, but even the kings, even the professionals, they all took up Buddhism. And because the whole idea is to get rid of suffering, you just become inactive. You don't want to do anything. And gradually, the system became so weak that the invaders took advantage of it, and then the Brahmanical class took over again. And that was the end. But it went to other countries. It wasn't just exterminated and never to be seen again. It went to Nepal, it went to Tibet, it went to Sri Lanka, it went to Southeast Asia, all the way to Japan and Korea, all throughout China and Taiwan. That's where you found Buddhism today. And they each have a different way to practice. Based on what? On their material desires. Because Buddhism is pretty much, it's just a way of life. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of feeling. Nirvana. Stop material desires, which is pretty much impossible. So, devotees, they have an opportunity to do something positive for themselves and for the people. And I was thinking about the idea of sacred space. Sri Dhammayapur is a sacred space. You don't have to create it. It's already there. Even if 500 years ago it was a jungle here, it's always been a sacred space. Jagannath Das, Babaji Maharaj and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur have the vision. Yes, here Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared. This is the holy dham, Sri Navadvip dham. This is where the pastime took place. So it's established. But whether they found it or not, it's always been the holy dham. Vrindavan was the same before the Goswamis arrived, and even before that, Vrindavan was a jungle. Sometimes you see those old paintings of Jagannath Puri also. What you see is you see the temple and you see the beach. That's all there is. But these places are sacred space. They are directly the spiritual world. Now the devotees can create a sacred space with their consciousness and with material elements. What is that called? A temple. You create a temple made of cement and bricks and paint and metal and wood and floors, and you install the deities in the temple, you install the acharya in the temple, you begin establishing the practice of devotional service. You have a sacred space. It is the spiritual world. Within the confine of that property, it's the spiritual world. So when the new devotees, when people join and they move into the temple, it's like, wow, this is Vaikuntha. I never want to get out from here. But then the temple president calls you and says, you're out tomorrow. And when you step out the door, wow, what am I going to do now? Surrender. You have the opportunity to walk down the street with your book bag or your prasadam bag or with your mridanga, or you can cross the road and have a beer. The choices are there all the time. I remember the very first Haranam, not that I saw, but that I participated in the students' area of Paris, just freshly shaved. It's like, you know, you still feel the wow. And then the Haranam party is going on, and I was right at the back, and then somebody tapped on my shoulder. There's some people on the street say, what's this all about? You know, what is this? Where are you guys coming from? What's your philosophy? And I thought, well, I'm going to talk to them. And within 10 minutes, I was surrounded by about 50 people, like, you know, the French. And I was like, hey, you know, you're a demon, you're a commie, you're just a meat eater. And I was like locked in. And I could hear the sound of the cartels just disappearing more and more and more. And I made my way back to the temple like 2 hours later. So the sacred space is so important for the devotees, but in that sacred space, the devotee have to learn to mature so that there's no more difference between the sacred space and the streets. Vaisheshika Prabhu can speak about this quite elaborately. I am sure that for him, the street is the temple, the street is the spiritual world, isn't it? So it's a challenge. And that takes us to, why live in the city? What is the purpose for living in the city? Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, cities is the mode of ignorance, right? Temple is pure goodness. If you're going to be in a city and you're not involved with temple activities, and that's not just the ISKCON temple down the street, it's your own home, or it's your Namahat places, like in China. We can't do Harinam. We can't have temples. We can't distribute prasadam, although we could. I guess we could, if it's well planned. We can't distribute books, even though we could, if we're smart enough. But it's dangerous. So what do the devotees have? We had this conversation in Prabhupada's room last night with the Chinese devotees. What do we have? It's not like, you know, Radhadesh. I mean, have you ever been to Radhadesh? It's like, where are we here? Is it which planet is this? Well, it's Goloka Vrindavan, Radha Gopinath, right? But come to China and see what happens, how the devotees manage to maintain their Krishna consciousness by meeting one afternoon once a week. And the rest of the week is just them, their family members, who oftentimes are not devotees, who oftentimes eat meat, and going to work. Mother Labunga, she's a school teacher. She has a temple at home, beautiful temple, small apartment on the top floor. Devotees always live on the top floor of the buildings because they think no one will hear the kirtans. But there's a price to pay for that. You gotta climb. Prabhu, we have a program on Saturday. Where is it? Oh, you know that Mataji. Oh, she's on the 12th floor, isn't she? There's no lift. No, there's no lift. Okay. But she has a beautiful temple at home with Jagannath deities, and she goes to work every day. And then it's 2 or 3 hours to go to work, 2 or 3 hours to come back. And then all day. But she found a very smart way. She must be a follower of Prahlad Maharaj, because she gave spiritual name to the children. And she even bring some of the teachers to our home. And somehow or other she gives some Krishna consciousness. But many, many of the devotees, it's constant struggles just to make it to their 16 rounds, to offer their food, to be able to squeeze a picture somewhere on the shelf in the apartment. There's one Mataji in Shanghai. She married a very nice, successful New Zealander who lives in Shanghai. She married him, they have 2 beautiful children, and then she bumps into the devotees in a yoga program. She's hooked. And she's a mother at home, she doesn't work. So now she has to start Krishna consciousness at home. And the husband doesn't want to know anything about it. She doesn't want to tell the children. Imagine what goes on. So she showed me she has a shelf that nobody even bothered going, and you open the shelf and there's a full altar there. So she just goes, and I saw her last year. We had a big festival in Shanghai. About 350 devotees came. And she, for the first time, she took a week off from her family, said, I'm going away. And she wore a sari, she wore tilak, because it was in a resort, it was quite insulated, so it was no problem. And I saw her, how she literally exploded of happiness just for that 1 week to practice Krishna consciousness fully. And then I asked her, I said, have you been in touch with your family? She says, no. And then she showed me her mobile. There were about 20 different texts. Mommy, where are you? Darling, where are you? Mommy, when are you coming back? So I said to her, get changed and go home. So I remember in 1988 when I think it was the second VIHE in Vrindavan, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj was teaching Harinam Chintamani and Nectar of Devotion. He had also introduced the fasting on Nirjali Kadashi. I mean, it was Nirjali Kadashi every Ekadashi. And we had to study all day and then stay up all night, chant in Prabhupada's room, and then go back to learning the next day and then have a feast at noontime. And then that started spreading to quite a few temples. In Australia, Atul Krishna and Shanti Parayana were like, you know, Nirjali Kadashi. Everybody had to do Nirjali Kadashi. But anyway, there were a handful of students of the VIHE who were quite successful, and Maharaj had his eyes on them, and he says, now you've completed your Bhakti Shastri, now you put everything into practice. And he took them to the mainland, and he put each devotee in different city, just to make new devotees and take care of the existing devotees. And they actually made quite a contribution over time to the Chinese Yatra. And I'm saying this because here in Srila Mayapur, there are many devotees who just spend such a long time studying Prabhupada's books. Of course, many are affiliated with a very specific temple somewhere else. But we have this huge neighboring country here. It's called China. It's growing very fast. It's very powerful. There are huge resources that can be tapped into. And we need help. We need a lot of help. And we need strong devotees who are mature and adventurous and who want to make a career move. Indrajumna Swami asked on that same VIHE period, he asked, he says, Goswami, I think I want to go to China. He said, very good. You tell me what I have to do. He said, grow your hair, wear kami clothes, don't talk to anyone, can't do festivals, can't chant, can't distribute books, can't go out on the street, and you only answer to me. And then he said, oh, by the way, and you pay your own ticket. So the rest is history. He went to Poland. And he has been making the attempt for 8 years in a row. He gets to Hong Kong and we try to corner him, but it's not easy. But we have senior devotees. Nishinga Maharaj here, he spends at least 4 months every year in the mainland. He's been there from day one. And there are other very senior devotees who come and visit. But it is a place that needs attention because these devotees are heroes, every single one of them. To be able to maintain a Krishna consciousness in that situation, I mean, you know, it's heroic. And I'm sure they're getting a lot of mercy from Srila Prabhupada for that. In conclusion, the lesson here is that we have to learn to use what comes our way and not try to imitate what other people do with the material energy, but to actually be smart enough to see, Krishna gave me this. What can I do for Krishna with that situation, with that place, with those facilities, with this manpower, with this amount of money. This is the way. Yukta Vairagya means this is the way to use everything in this material world in Krishna's service without even thinking that this is me who is doing this. If our name doesn't come up, if we're not being, you know, put on the pedestal and say, this is the person who did this, we're not interested in that. What we're interested in is Krishna's pleasure, is step by step to be able to give Krishna to other people for the pleasure of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, for the pleasure of the Acharyas, because this is what they plan. We are just instruments. We're just being sent here and there to do their work. As Vishnujan Swami, when he asked Prabhupada about why the mission wasn't complete, he says, Bhaktivinoda Thakur could have delivered the whole universe if he wanted to. But he left a few things for us to do. And those few things is actually lifetimes of service. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, Grihe Thako, Bane Thako, Sadahari Bane Thako, whether we are a householder, whether we are in a renounce order, whether we live in the forest on top of a tree, we live in a building on a 23rd floor of a skyscraper in the middle of Beijing, we engage in devotional service, we study Prabhupada's book thoroughly, and at every opportunity that we meet somebody, we give them Krishna. That's the proper use of our time, our energy, and our body and soul in the midst of this forest of material enjoyment. Hare Krishna. I don't think we have room for questions, so thank you very much for your attention. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Is there a gentleman Shia?
Well, I mean, is there?
Yeah, they are.
My stepmother is from.
খুব ভালো প্রশ্ন।
Thank you.